I'm delighted to welcome you all to the CDAM Foundation lecture. Before we begin, you'll be pleased to know the really exciting news from another place this afternoon. That is 1p off the standard rate of income tax, allowances raised by £700, but no extra tax on whisky. I'd like to welcome our guests, especially those who've come some way from outside the LSE, and remind you that this is in fact the centenary of the LSE. The LSE was founded in 1895, and throughout this year the school has been celebrating its centenary year. In fact, this is practically the last event of the centenary year, but of course it's extremely significant because it's really the first event of the next century. Mathematics hasn't, to be quite frank, played a particularly strong part in the first century of the LSE, but we are convinced and we are sure that it will play a greater part in the second century. Soon after the school was founded, Professor Bowley, who was one of the first professors here, Professor of Statistics, wrote a textbook on statistics, and in the first edition, which was published around 1900, he tried very hard to avoid using any mathematics at all. When he came to write, I think it was the fourth edition, around 1920, by that time he'd given up the unequal struggle, and he says in his preface that if you really want to understand statistics, then of course you've got to do some work and learn some mathematics, calculus and so forth, matrix algebra, before you start. And that really was the story of mathematics at the LSE until fairly recently, the gradual increase in the use of mathematics, the level of mathematics required in order to understand statistical techniques, which of course have always been part of the school's portfolio, that led to an increasing amount of teaching of mathematics, which was done in the main initially by statisticians like Sir Maurice Kendall and latterly Sir Roy Allen, who taught a very widely known course on mathematical analysis for economists, which a famous book which is still in print. In 1966, the school decided in the post-Robbins era that it should have a group of mathematicians to carry out this mathematics teaching. And it was lucky to attract as the first professor of mathematics, Professor Cyril Offord. We had hoped Professor Offord might be with us today, but he's written to me. He says, I had hoped to attend your foundation lecture Tuesday, but I am now 89 and I do not like travelling to London in inclement weather. However, he sends us his best wishes and says mathematics has come a long way since its small beginnings in 1966. Well, where it's come to, of course, is the foundation of a mathematics department. Formerly we were part of a statistical and mathematical sciences department, now we're a mathematics department. That happened just over a year ago, and then very recently, and what we're here to, in a way, inaugurate today, the Centre for Discrete and Applicable Mathematics. And it's a great pleasure to introduce Bill Pulleyblank, who's going to give this foundation lecture, as we've rather grandly called it. Bill has held chairs in several universities, most notably, I think, in Waterloo in Canada, which, as many of you will know, is one of the world's leading centres for combinatorics and optimization, the kind of mathematics that we're particularly strong on here. He's been editor of the Journal of Combinatorial Theory, which is one of the leading journals in the area, and he is currently director of mathematical sciences at IBM in New York. When we offered, when we asked him to come, we didn't really specify any subject for him to talk on, and the title that he's given us surprises us a little. So all of us are keen to learn how Bill is going to address the subject of dealing with uncertainty in finance models. Professor Pulleyblank.
How will I deal with that? I'm not sure. Thank you very much, and it's really a great pleasure to be here and to see so many friends. Let me just, can you see that all right? Is that good? you can't see it a bit, can you, right? I don't know if, let me just, shall I, is that all right? I guess the question that I've had the most posed to me from my friends whom I've known for some time, many of whom are here, is, Polly Blank, what are you doing talking about uncertainty in finance? And I guess I'll come clean and explain that since I've been at IBM now, which has been around 5 years, this has been one of the main research directions that our department has been going on. And there are several reasons for it. Like, one is the obvious opportunities that present themselves to apply mathematics. I think the second is that where we are located in New York, just north of New York City, we're very close to probably the second finance capital of the world. That would be the Wall Street area. And there is a regular flow of people, I'd like to say, to and from IBM Research and Wall Street. It tends to be pretty unidirectional, I must say. But before I begin, I think I'm going to start with a bit of a confession. When I was at Waterloo, I had a position of director of mathematics for industry and commerce. And one of the groups that I associated with then was the accounting and finance group. And I remember my first thought when I had a luncheon meeting scheduled with the director of accounting. And I really wanted to understand, are there finance problems, are there research problems in accounting? Now, what research problems could possibly present themselves in finance? Because I thought that once you knew what the left and the right-hand side of your balance sheet were, that was really all the issue was. And I was wrong. And I'd like to tell you about some of the applications that we've been working on. Now, the common thread in what I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to describe, in fact, three particular applications. By the way, if I stray from a microphone, are you still able to hear me well enough? Okay, then I will move a bit. Yeah, there are really three applications I want to talk to you about. These are three particular instances where we were able to take a finance or finance-based problem, develop a solution which you can put on computers and actually use to solve some problems. So there is a computational and a practical element to it. The three things I'd like to talk about, first of all, the issue of balancing risk versus expected return. Actually, the second of all, that is my second topic, which is the portfolio optimization area. The first one I'm going to talk about is work we've been doing in trying to understand how to deal with rare and unpredictable events. And in particular, this is work we've been doing with an insurance company, which I'll tell you about. The last part is a bit of work that we've been doing in research, which has gotten a large amount of press attention in the last while, particularly in the US. And it may be because of this particular solution that we put out. And somebody in marketing called this the deterministic simulation blaster. Now, you can imagine anything that you call the blaster is surely going to get a lot of attention. And to my surprise, a few weeks ago when I was in research, I was talking to a group of my fellow managers, and in walked Lou Gerstner, who is the chairman of IBM. And Gerstner walked in and looked at the room and said, I'll tell you one thing I like that's come out of research this year, I like the blaster. And I think Lou's idea now is that we can have all kinds of blasters. He doesn't know what it does, but he thinks it's good to have one. So that'll be the third part I'd like to tell you about. Let me begin by talking about life in the insurance industry. I'm going to do a little bit of a... show it up here. Insurance is a risky business. This was driven home in the United States in 1992 when there was an event which was called Hurricane Andrew, which hit Florida. Do you recall this? I don't know if it got press attention over here. You see, the interesting thing about the insurance companies is that, among other sources of uncertainty, one thing they have to estimate is what's the likely amount of damage they're going to incur that they're insuring for, and hence they have to pay out. Now, I'd like you to look at this chart, which shows the amount of damage caused by hurricanes over the last roughly 120 years. Now, you notice what happened in the period from about 1970 through 1990. This was the period in which everybody was keeping careful records of claim amounts. There was a lot of information being preserved. And you see what happened here is that very, very low amounts of damage. When Andrew hit, it literally, I should say, blew off the map. It was a very strange phenomenon, actually, as we were sitting there in the United States watching this hurricane approach. There's nothing quite like watching a hurricane approach, because with the current weather forecast, they pinpoint literally to the hour when it's going to strike. And they'll show the cameras will be on this quiet Florida town. It'll say, well, it looks pretty good now. It's 6 o'clock, but in 45 minutes, this will be completely destroyed. Now, why you want to watch that, I don't know, but it was a phenomenon that went on. So the difficulty you see that happens is, when you're planning for this kind of catastrophic event, how should you try and deal with it? The thing is that, how do they generate the money with which they pay these kinds of claims? In fact, what they do is they maintain a portfolio, and they have investments in various types of goods. And the normal type of work that most companies get into when they're managing a portfolio is to try and decide how best to allocate resources within these various types of instruments. There's also, by the way, a premium part, which is being input in. And the normal kind of uncertainty which most companies deal with, of course, is the uncertainty of the financial markets. Do interest rates go up or go down, and so forth? The case of the insurance company is they've got the liability side, which we've seen can result in massive effects to the portfolio. And so now when they have to manage risk, they've got the two kinds of risk which they have to deal with. Just see. One is the finance risk, and the other is the uncertainty of claims. Now, the difficulty with this kind of a risk problem is that you can't really just take the average. If you just say the average damage is this much, we should go ahead and plan for that. The variance is so high that it's not going to put you in the right position. So one of the techniques which is used is what's called stochastic optimization. And stochastic optimization is a technique which has several characteristics, I guess. One is that it does provide a rigorous, systematic way of trying to deal with these kinds of risk situations. The other advantage to it is that if you imagine taking the largest mathematical programming model which you've got on your computer, and then you add the element of stochastic optimization to it, it probably makes the model anywhere from 100 to 1,000 times larger. And that can be wonderful news if you're in the computer business. So we accept that. Now, here's the idea of what's going to happen. At a present time, we may have certain types of investments, a certain type of claims. Based upon that, we could go ahead and write an optimization program to solve it and tell us the best allocation of resources. The unfortunate thing is that we go to the next year, for example, and this is when uncertainty is going to be coming in. We may know what the interest rates are here, which would tell us the right mix of investments. What's it going to do next year? Will it go up? Will it go down? Depending on what it does, what sort of a decision should we make? So what we really want to be able to do is say, well, let's look at the model, and we'll start with the current scenario, which we know pretty well. We know what's going on. Next year, there may be several different scenarios which can take place. For each of those, the following year, there may be several different scenarios. And as you go further and further into the future, more and more possible scenarios present themselves. The question is, how do you deal with this kind of a problem? Another question you consider is, how do you generate this kind of scenario? One of the interesting things that these companies have right now, and in particular that Allstate was very good at, was they had simulation models which could go ahead and simulate massive numbers of scenarios into the future. The first step which we would take in dealing with this kind of a problem was to discretize this scenario world. The idea was that if you look at the way, for example, some financial measure could move into the future, we wanted to try and break it down into this discrete scenario structure. So in fact, there was an analysis that would be done to actually begin by bucketing the different values you might have into appropriate levels, and then looking at the sequences of levels as you went forward with time. And then finally a consolidation stage, which would actually take these scenarios and try and construct what we would now call a scenario tree. So the idea is that this may say no change in interest rates, followed by a drop in interest rates. Following that, there could be two alternatives which could take place, and so forth. The interesting thing about this was that obviously this construction of the scenarios is a key to doing a stochastic model. Many companies have simulation types of routines that they can use to generate many scenarios. The idea of selecting them, discretizing them into this discrete tree is one of the keys to making the stochastic side work. The actual issue of how you take these scenarios, the continuous variables, and how you break it into the discrete ranges is a combination, that says there, of art and science. Why is it important? Well, of course, you'd like the smallest number of buckets you can manage and still get a good model. The more buckets you put in, the more your tree is going to explode as you go forward. The smaller the number of buckets, the less you're going to do. Here, for example, is in hurricanes, where we could actually break it into three possible scenarios. Massive storm, moderate storm, low impact storm, and these are the probabilities of each of these scenarios occurring. Now, once this work has been done and we understand the scenarios as well as the probabilities of obtaining it, then we get to the stage where we can actually begin to model the uncertainty. And so this comes back to the idea which I was saying before, that if we have a scenario tree now, which says here's the first stage, two scenarios here, this branches into multiple scenarios here. As we take, for example, a linear program, we might have the model which describes one scenario. When we go to stage two, we get blocks. We go to the next stage, we get blocks. We get this particular form of block-structured matrix, which actually represents the mathematical programming problem which we are trying to solve. You see, the key factor on it is, of course, that the variables which correspond here are these decision variables, which are really the important ones. They're going to tell us what kind of an investment choice we should make at the present time. The variables for this set of columns and this set of columns are going to say, here's what you would do in scenario one, here's what you would do in scenario two, and so on and so forth. Now, are you going to actually do what these variables tell you to do? Probably not, because probably a year from now we'll resolve the model and we'll get a new set of decisions. What are these really doing, though? The effect of these decisions are coming back to influence the choice that's being made on those decisions. Does that make some sort of sense? Yeah? Let me ask you this. Okay, let's just see. Let's test the intuition. Suppose I did it, looked at a stochastic problem, and there were only two scenarios to be considered. And let me give you an example of one which we did a little south of here. This is in the canton of Geneva. This was work, a model which was done using the Markel energy model. And what it was designed to look at was different ways of generating electrical power. And what's the most cost-effective combination of capital investments to be made? There is one major source of uncertainty that the canton is facing. In the year 2000, France has got a date fixed at which they're going to pass a law regarding importation of nuclear power from France. And they may say, we're not going to import nuclear power to Switzerland any longer, or they may say, yes, we're going to permit it freely. Two different scenarios. Okay, test your intuition. Is it clear to you that one way, that when I want to find out what's the best decision to make, in view of the uncertainty as to whether they put these constraints on the model, and which it says it says here probably is 25% that it'll constrain the amount of power it will send in, if I make, is it clear to you that the right answer should somehow be in between the solution that says, if they don't constrain it, if they do constrain it? In some ways, would you agree that it would be sensible to say, look, let's at least figure out what to do if they don't put the constraints on? Let's figure out what to do if they do put the constraints on, and something in between would probably be the right answer. Does that make sense? It's pretty plausible. Yeah, it's wrong. That's not true. And I'll just show you an example here from the case which we ran. These were different technologies. The solution was much larger. These are three particular technologies. And when we ran the stochastic model, this was the amount of the investment we placed in each one of these three areas. Now, the interesting thing there is, look, for example, at the case of electricity, water, heat. It's a heat generation. The stochastic solution said you should put 0.125, whatever the unit was, into that particular source. Unconstrained was 0.110. Constrained was 0.05. You're saying you should put more in it. Why would you do that? I mean, your reaction is probably the same as mine initially was, there may be a programming bug here, but no, it's not that. Well, the reason is you're investing in a particular investment which is going to reduce the uncertainty of the decision. In other words, there may be an investment which you want to take which reduces the cost of the uncertainty, even though it in itself would not be a good thing to do if you knew for sure what was going to happen in the future. And you see, this is a very important feature of these stochastic models, is that when you solve the stochastic model, you get a solution which is not in the convex hull of the solutions you get by considering the individual scenarios. But it's what it gives. Now, the other thing, this is a frustrating thing as an optimizer, is you can get the solution which the stochastic solution recommends. You know that whatever happens, this will be suboptimal, right? Whichever scenario we end up in the future, there was a better solution. We've in some way hedged risk in order to position ourselves better in this uncertain world. It's a little disappointing because you'd like to be able to always guarantee that you're doing the best thing possible, but you really have to accept the model. So this was one example in Geneva. When we looked at the insurance company, we came up with another issue. We looked at the insurance company's goal, which was trying to decide how to allocate their resources in order to handle these future claims with the uncertainties. One of the problems which we had with them is it's a multi-criteria optimization problem. And in fact, the right decision is very arguable because the actual criteria which they want to use varies. They may want to trade off, for example, capital versus income, risk-based versus price to share ratio. And so in fact, what the output of the particular model is a family of curves. And then they can make a kind of a policy decision which says, we feel most happiest with us being positioned about here. We're positioned about, say, here. Then there's the location we should be on. So in fact, what this kind of a model does is actually provides a range of alternatives to decision makers who can then make their decisions to where they feel happiest to position their company on it. The overall result with this particular model, which we did, as I said, with Allstate, is that they're running a $35 billion property and casualty portfolio using it. Hundreds of these base models had to be run to construct a sufficient surface, which I just showed you. 1,500 simulations, 6-year time horizon. When it came time to solve the base model, of course, one of the problems is that solving it so many times, we actually had to have a pretty efficient way of solving it. So there were specialized decomposition things. In fact, many of the classical methods of operations research, such as your Bender's decomposition or Danzig-Wolf decomposition, become extremely relevant when you start looking at these stochastic models. When we looked at the time it took, it was approximately 2 days of runtime for the initial models. When we went to a decomposition, it went down to 45 minutes. Running on parallel machines, we got it down to about 5 minutes
to run these models now. And why is that? Well, it just happens that particular structure of model, which I showed you with this staircase structure, lends itself beautifully to this kind of a parallel direction. So that's where we're going on the insurance stuff. And that's what stochastic optimization is trying to do.
Is that 1,500 simulation passes or 1,500 paths on the tree?
That was 1,500 simulations.
How many paths would it be on
the
tree? After you bucket.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying. It would probably be around 40, 45, 50, something of that order.
And that'd be both assets and liabilities?
Yes, that was looking, they were both, it would include both those kinds of uncertainty. That's correct. Now, what we were doing with the Allstate was trying, what this model was doing, the one I described to you, was trying to decide how to split the assets in the portfolio in the various investment classes. What should go into bonds, what should go into stocks, what should go into the various grades of investments, and how best to balance the portfolio. The actual choices that should be made were, in fact, within any one of those sectors, was the basis of portfolio optimization. And I'd like to say a little bit about portfolio optimization as my second topic here, for several reasons. One of the fun things I did when I was a professor is I would give my students term projects to do in operations research. And I remember when I was maybe the first or second year I did it, one student came up to me and he said, "I would like to do a program that will tell me the best investment to make in the stock market." And I said, "Hey, that's going to be a very good idea. That's a very worthwhile project, and you'll give me the program as your assignment." And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Now tell me, do you have an idea how you're going to do this?" And he said, "Yes." Maybe close the door. I said, "Come on in, we'll shut the door. Sit down." And he said, "Here's what I've done. I've got an estimate for everything in the Toronto Stock Exchange, every instrument. I think I know how much each one's going to go up." I said, "Good, this is sounds promising. And now I'm going to write a linear program to go ahead and pick the best portfolio out of that." And I said, "Well, that's a very interesting idea. Are there any constraints you're going to put on it?" And he laughed as if to say, "What do you think I am, a dummy?" I said, "Of course I am. I'm going to put in a constraint that says you must use a positive amount, or non-negative amount of any instrument you use." "That's okay, he's not a short seller. He doesn't want to get into the risk." And I said, "Well, anything else?" He said, "No, that's it." So I said, "So I understand, what you're going to do is you're going to put all this data in, you're going to say, minimize the expected value of any mixture of these items given to the constraint that it's non-negative." He said, "Right." And I said, "Well, you don't need a linear programming package to solve that, because what is the solution? You look at the one that's got the best estimate for all your eggs in that basket." And I remember I tried to explain it to him, and he knew deep down that it wasn't going to do that, because computers were his friend. He knew the computer would understand the value of diversification, and so he put it in. And so then he came back and saw me the next day and said, "The darndest thing happened. It just told me to buy one thing, and that's dumb. So, but I've got a new idea. What I'm going to do is put in another constraint which says you can't buy more than this amount of that first instrument," and rerun the problem. And he did, and he came back the next day and he said, "Well, I've doubled the number of instruments in my portfolio. It's now I've picked the best one and the second best one." And, which seemed like a good time to lead into a bit of quadratic optimization. That's one of the way I first came across this. The other thing that's related to this, which particularly pleased me, is shortly after I had joined IBM, Harry Markowitz got the Nobel Prize for the work he had done on portfolio optimization. And why does it please me? Well, it pleased me because Harry was at IBM Research at a time when he did some of this work, so there was that sort of connection. And shortly after he won the prize, he came back and spent a day with us, and we were talking about the kind of things we were doing, the kind of things that he had done. Let me describe basically what the Markowitz model did, and this is classical by now. In fact, I was just checking some of the finance textbooks around on the shelves here, and I see that most of them do refer to the Markowitz model. What the model does is it says, really, we're going to minimize the cost of the instruments we buy, There's some linear constraints which we'll put on our investments, some bounds on the amount. These constraints are the kind of ones that say, I don't want you to put more than a certain amount into a particular sector. I want you to maintain some kinds of balance. But really the key is this quadratic term, isn't it? And the quadratic term is the one that looks at the interplays of instruments with each other. And by trying to drive that down, this gives you this trade-off of the risk versus the return. And this is what gives you the sort of the balancing that the Markowitz model gives. As I mentioned at the bottom here, one of the things about the Markowitz model is it can handle budget constraints, turnover constraints, some of these types of constraints on it. Have any of you used Markowitz models too? A bit? What are the weaknesses of the Markowitz model? If there's some finance people here, even if you look at this problem, one of the problems of the Markowitz model is that how does it deal with risk? It tends to really fragment your holdings. What it will tend to do is tell you to take very, very small positions in a vast number of instruments, because that will cause this quadratic term to reduce. Another problem with the Markowitz model is that it has difficulty dealing with things, with constraints you may want to put in your portfolio, like, I don't want to have too many instruments in my portfolio. If you're a real fund manager, it matters to you how many instruments you're holding. And if I say to you, I'd like to have a portfolio with 400 instruments in it, they say, this is far too complex for me to handle. Give me one with 15 instruments. And these types of constraints are the ones which cause some difficulty to this particular model. The other thing that just one other comment, which is actually not a weakness of the Markowitz model, but I should mention. If we look at the variables here, we have one variable for each of the instruments which we can put into the portfolio. So if we want to look at, for example, 1,000 possible investments, that's 1,000 variables here, which is not so bad. The difficulty here is, with this quadratic matrix, which is looking at 1,000 by 1,000, this covariance between these elements, 1,000 times 1,000, even in the UK, gives 1,000,000. And so these matrices tend to be very large. And in fact, where the data comes from this kind of matrix is a bit of a problem. What's typically done is people use factor models, which are ways of defining a number of different factors. And based upon that set of factors, you get a derived cost. That just describes how that works for the different instruments. And so, in fact, then you can simplify the model a bit because you're using these factor tables which are provided. And incidentally, with many of the companies that sell portfolio optimization tools, the optimization part, the Markowitz part, is all the same. The difference in the tools they sell is what they've done with the factor models. And some people feel they've got very good factor models which give you very good estimates of the covariance. Now, the other thing that was interesting about the work that came out of this is that we really are in a position, again, of having a multi-criteria problem, so that what we have to do is we're looking at expected return, we're looking at risk, we're looking at a trade-off, and there is this notion which was introduced of the efficient frontier. The idea of that is that if you are in this region, there are portfolios which will give you this kind of value. If what you would like to do in general is either say, I don't want my risk to exceed a certain value, subject to that, get me as much return as you can. Alternatively, and then particularly in some of the portfolios that support fixed instruments, you say, I must get this element of return, subject to that, do it in as risk-free a way as possible. The particular portfolio you pick is always one you would always like to have, one which is on this efficient frontier. The idea being that if you're not on the frontier, you can either decrease the risk and get the same return, or you could keep your risk at the same level and increase the expected return. Okay, and that's what the efficient frontier is about. Now, here was one of the things which we wanted to add to it. And that was the ability to handle something like position sizes, transaction sizes, and number of instruments. And that's again where the discrete mathematics really becomes the issue. How do you model this? So for example, here is a way of modeling our holding in a particular instrument. We currently hold a certain position in that instrument. Now, if we're going to make any transaction at all, it has to be at least a certain size. So we don't permit an infinitesimal shift in transaction. If you move at all, you must jump at least to some significant difference. If you do make a transaction, then if you're decreasing your holding, you can only go to a certain position, after which, if you want to go beyond that, you have to liquidate it. You're not going to permit yourself to switch to a totally small position. You can go to a certain limit as far as a larger position. This is the type of constraint which is very easily handled with integer variables. Now, the other thing which some of the mathematicians here will may have recognized is this is no longer a linear cost function either, is it? It's a piecewise linear function, and it's in fact it's saying that if I decide I want to buy a lot of this, the cost may change at this point and start to become steeper. Why would that be? Make any sense? It's not economies of scale, is it? The economies of scale would say the more I buy, the cheaper it should get. This is the opposite of that. And do you know why that is? I'll tell you what. If you want to be to understand it, here's what I would suggest. Look at the closing price of IBM stock today and go out tomorrow and just for fun, buy 1 million shares of IBM stock at that price. Okay. You'll see when you do that that your first ones you maybe do pretty well, but by about this time the market knows that you've begun to make a play, at which point the price is going to go up. So that's what this is reflecting here, is the ability to actually affect market by your transaction sizes when they get to a certain limit, which does become an issue for some of the larger fund holders. Okay, how do you go ahead and deal with this kind of integer variables which you need in order to model this type of constraint? Really, the gratifying point on this is that you can use one of the fundamental methods of discrete mathematics of integer programming, and that's the branch and bound type of structure, which in fact deals with the integer variables by means of a successively constrained problem as you go down kind of a decision tree to make your decisions. And what we did is we took the Markowitz model and combined it into this integer branch and bound type of a framework in order to get a way that we could actually start imposing these types of constraints. One thing I'll mention on it that was interesting on it, some of the constraints, which were ones that said, if you make a change in position, you must move at least a certain amount, or if you have a position, it has to be in this range, were fine. The one sorts of constraints which we found were extremely difficult to deal with are the ones that say, I don't want to have more than 24 stocks in my portfolio. These kind of global constraints turned out to be the most difficult ones to handle. There's one other drawback of the Markowitz model, which is often has been dealt with pretty well since it came out, and that's the question about why do you consider risk to be symmetric? The basic Markowitz model says that we'll penalize an investment for overexceeding the expected rate of return as much as we will for underachieving the expected rate of return. And as you know, in many situations, that's not really what you want to do. You'd like to say, yeah, if you do better than expected, that's wonderful. But if you do worse than expected, that's where I'm going to penalize you. And that led to the notion of trying to model asymmetric risk. And so, in fact, one thing we did is we added a stochastic component to this as well, much like we were talking about before with the insurance industry, which would allow this modeling of asymmetric risk. So the asymmetric risk now would say, here's your expected return. If you do less than that, I'm going to complain. If you do more than that, no penalty. Overachieve, that's fine. We're not going to, that's no problem with us. And in fact, this type of family of curves we used, as you can probably see from looking at it, is a family where we have a linear piece, a quadratic piece, and a linear piece. So we would allow risk to be actually specified by using these three pieces. Now, here, and then we ran this model through on it. I'll show you the kind of results which we were obtaining. Here, for example, is the output of one of the runs. This is showing the risk versus expected return
And there's the efficient frontier. If you were to actually come up here and stand right where I am, and I'm not recommending it, but what you would notice is there's a little bit of red right there. That's because we, in fact, selected a particular portfolio from the efficient frontier and took that portfolio, and then we ran 1,000 random trials against it to see what the return was. And that's what this histogram now represents, is the fraction of returns which we got above, maybe I just raised 100, is compared to the expected value. And you notice this had the effect we hoped, in that this was the mean. There were some times we'd be unlucky, we actually got less than expected, but most of the time we would tend to drift up ahead of it. If we had run it with a symmetric risk, what would have happened is it would have been a symmetric function which would have gotten out. So this was in fact achieving the kind of things which we were intending to do. Okay. Now, just for the sort of the statistics on this one, this work was done with a company called Panagora Asset Management, who does portfolio management. If we took like a 600 stock portfolio Markowitz model, these we can solve really fast now. That's 30 seconds on a fast notebook computer. One of the questions that comes up is, can you really do series optimization on a notebook computer? And the answer is sure. This is pretty respectable. If we want, that's for a single portfolio, to completely compute the efficient frontier, which involves running through several hundred portfolios, would take a couple of minutes. When we added the integrality constraints and actually took into this much more realistic model, it would take up to 10 minutes or maybe sometimes even hours on a fairly good-sized workstation. Interestingly enough, when we took this and presented it to the traders, their reaction to it was they liked it a lot, not because they necessarily believed the answers were better than what they were getting with the standard Markowitz model, but because of the feasibility constraints which were put in there. They said the solutions they were giving were things they could basically execute without filtering. So that turned out to be a large part of the value that they saw in it. Now, the last part I'm going to tell you about is BLASTR. And this is this corporate risk management. And this is where getting into one of the more traditional areas of finance, and that's this whole notion of derivative securities. And these are the kinds of securities that corporations and sometimes individuals like to use to protect themselves against fluctuations in these various parameters. Do people deal in options here? It's an interesting point, isn't it? Because this is a situation that I can see arising in our company, because at IBM, for example, there's an employee stock purchase plan. So over the years, people have invested a lot in IBM stock. Now, for years, that was viewed as just, you know, this is the best thing to do, but some of the people who bought stock at $180 and saw it slip to $46 were a little upset by the value of their investment, and it gave a whole new meaning to the term volatility. The problem is, you see, imagine that you're someone who has a child who's about to enter college in the United States, let's say in September. What month are we now? November. Good. Say it's next September. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the free enterprise system of the United States, college education is a financial disaster which ranks only second to hurricanes. The cost of sending a child to college is anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000 to sometimes $40,000 per year. Unless you can somehow get your child really occupied so they fail out of college after the first year, they're probably going to want to do it for 4 years. If you didn't plan ahead, you may have two children who don't differ in age by 4 years. So if I'm sitting there with my IBM stock and I checked and the last price as of whenever it was say $96 a share, and that's what I've got that college fund locked up in, what am I going to do about next year? It's very tempting to say, I'll let it ride. If it goes back down to 46, I could be in big trouble. I could sell it and move it into some other kind of an instrument, couldn't I? But in fact, what people are trying to do, and what people are doing in some cases, they're buying derivative instruments, put options, which will give them the right to sell it at a fixed price a year from now, which hedges them against this kind of a bet. And that's what we're talking about on this, is how you can do that kind of an investment. The particular instance I'll talk about is something which is called CMOs, or collateralized mortgage obligations. These are derivative instruments which are based on pools of mortgages. So taking residential mortgages, pooling them together in order to develop a derivative instrument. If you look at the cash flow from derivative from mortgages, there are two sorts. There's the interest payment, which comes in monthly and is very predictable in most cases. There's also the principal payment, which may come in if somebody pays off their mortgage. What's the major cause of uncertainty as to what these instruments are going to generate? Do you know? It's interest rates. Most people who've got a mortgage which is, say, at 12%, when the interest rates drop to 6%, are going to say it's a good time to refinance. And so whereas somebody has been quite gleefully collecting the interest on that instrument, when people refinance, there's a shot of principal, that interest goes away. So it's the fluctuation in interest rate which causes a lot of the uncertainty in that. The mortgages in one of these pools are broken up into what are called tranches, les tranches, and these are selections of mortgages which have very similar characteristics, similar prepayment risk, similar maturity. Now, the idea of how to model these is quite classical in finance. The idea is that you're going to use what are called Monte Carlo methods to evaluate them. What Monte Carlo methods do is they're based on randomization. And what it says is, let's suppose, for example, that interest rates are the variable that's going to mostly affect how this particular portfolio behaves. I could imagine a number of different scenarios that could take place over the next, say, 5 years as far as what interest rates will do. Any possible sequence that interest rates might follow would become one scenario that might happen. And I could, in fact, consider scenario one, scenario two, as many as I like. For each one of those, I could look and see what, in particular, this collection of options would do. It has a certain cash flow over that time, and I could look at the present value that I would have computed based upon that scenario. What I'd like to do is get the expected value over all these possible scenarios. And the idea is then, well, why don't I just try a bunch of random scenarios? I hope I can generate them in a way that somehow reflects reality. And then I can fall back on every mathematician's best friend, the law of large numbers. And it says, I guarantee you, absolutely, and I'll put this in writing, without fail, that if you run enough of these random samples, it will converge to the right answer. Which sounds like terrific news when you first hear it. And when one of you says, could I just ask one question, what is enough? I say, no, that wasn't in the guarantee, please. What we do know is the law of large numbers says that we should be converging at a rate of about inversely proportional to the square root of the number of samples that I try. So in fact, as I hope to get closer and closer, I'm going to have to run sort of quadratically many samples to get there. And you'll also notice I didn't put a constant in there because we don't know what it is. But it's still comforting to know that if you run long enough, you're going to get there. Now, the model that I like to think of on this is this one that I'm sure intrigued many of you when you were kids, is this idea that if you want to compute the value of pi, what you could do is just draw a circle on a square, stand it across the room and throw darts at it, and count the number of times the dart hit the board, the number of times, and you know, landed in the circle, the number of times it hit the paper, forget the times it missed the board completely, and then look at that ratio, and that should convert to pi as you're throwing up darts. Did any of you ever try that? Yeah, it takes a lot of darts, and it sort of mangled the paper. I tried it mathematically, and it sounded so good, you just knew it had to work, and it gives a new meaning to the idea of slow convergence. Let me show you why. Okay, do you all see the hidden picture in here? No. These are pseudo-random points, generated with a random number generator and thrown into the plane. You notice there's some clumping and some white space?
You see what's here? That looks kind of random, isn't it? But do you notice there's a difference? What do you see? Do you see a qualitative difference there? Pardon? Yeah, it looks sort of more set. It looks sort of a little bit more regular, doesn't it? Now, could you imagine that if I were going to be dropping a circle in here, and I was going to try and compute the ratio of its area to the big box, which set of points is likely to do better for me? Well, this is an example. It's called a low discrepancy sequence. This is a set of points which, in some sense, is trying to simulate a pseudo-random sequence. But in fact, what it's trying to do it without the uncertainty that randomness would give you. In fact, what it's trying to do is systematically generate a very uniform coverage across your particular region. So that's the difference between pseudo-random distributions and low discrepancy distributions. And the idea was, if we took a look at some of these financial instruments which you're trying to evaluate, and we have to generate all these scenarios, and for each scenario we have to evaluate the instrument over time, wouldn't it be nice if somehow by taking this idea of low discrepancy, we could bring it down to a much smaller set of tests which would have to be done. And so that led to the idea of doing estimation using these low discrepancy sequences. Now there's a particular measure of discrepancy which is basically says, look at the boxes which are in your region and count how many of your deterministic set of points lie in that box compared to what should be the right number. And that's kind of the discrepancy, is how big that number gets to be. The theorem, and what math talk would not have a theorem in it, the theorem says there do exist sequences which are of low discrepancy. In fact, what it's saying is the error is now bounded by a log factor on the numerator, but you notice the denominator is now linear in n instead of square root of n, which says it's converging much, much faster. So that was the idea. Could we use these low discrepancy sequences on it? And there has been a substantial amount of research done. I'll just mention some of the types of low discrepancy sequences which are available. And if you're interested in this kind of a subject, there's one of these CBMS NSF monographs, which I can give you the reference to afterwards, on these methods, which is in it. And it just gives you some of the particular sequences. The idea, one of the points to mention is that the dimensionality of the thing you're trying to model becomes an issue. Here's how to do it in a one-dimensional model, then it can be generalized to higher dimensions. What is the effect of these sequences? Well, it's kind of interesting. There's the results of tracking. Now, what we're seeing there is running 200,000, 400,000, up to 1 million trials. Let me just get the dots for the pictures right. The dotted line here represents a random set of points, which are generated using a random number generator. Dotted line here is another random set of points, which you notice is wandering around. Notice here are these two sets of random points, which are still showing quite a variation in where they were even after a million tests. Using the low discrepancy sequences, which are the other two, you see a much faster convergence and a much, much quicker convergence to what we believe is the true value. Typically, what we're finding is that in literally hundreds of thousands of tests, you can now achieve what used to take millions of tests by using randomization.
What's the computed value? Is it average?
The value it's showing is... That is the expected... That's its estimate to the expected value of the instrument. And so it's adjusting that as it goes ahead and can use more and more values. And why does this matter? Well, it matters because what typically happens in the finance world is that I may offer a particular instrument onto the market and say, these are now available to you, would you like to buy them? And you're going to sit down and try and decide whether you want to buy it. How will you decide it? Will you run your computer on it? And then suddenly you look at this instrument and say, whoa, that is a terrific buy to me. Yes, I'd like it. I'll take so much of it. And when you send me the messages, say you'd like it. Unfortunately, they're all gone. because your method was too slow. On the other hand, if that happens too often to you, you say, I'm not going to take any risk, I'm going to, or, that's the wrong way to say it, I'm going to buy it as soon as it's offered. If you buy too quickly, you have the opposite problem. So in fact, this ability to compute these more efficiently is a very important component. Now the last thing which I'm going to do is end all uncertainty regarding the length of my talk. That is my last transparency. I'm going to stop at this point. Are there any questions? I'd be more than happy to discuss it with you.
Are there any questions for Bill?
Well, yes. Can I go to the last... I'm shocked at the behavior of one of the random number generators.
Yeah.
Explain to me why
it hasn't converged.
The one that drifts up at the end stands out, the dotted. Why did they have so badly?
Don't know why what's really happening there. And I mean, why does it look like they got close together and then drifted apart? One of the things I would have to, I mean, one factor may be that, of course, it's a pseudo-random number generator. It may be an inherent weakness in that particular generator. Don't know.
That's not good news,
but that's, yeah, that's...
And out of those four, only one seems to behave properly.
Which is...
One is your favorite.
So the Sobel?
Sobel, yeah.
Yeah. But I...
The canoe is quite fast in many states.
Yeah, it seemed to be very stable. The, it's an interesting question because, of course, when you look at what one of these deterministic... sequences is, it is a particular fixed sequence that you use, and then you use it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we've been finding is there's a certain robustness in it, that if you get a sequence that works well, it tends to work well even when you vary the model somewhat. The other problem is that this looks simple because this is when you look at low-dimensional models, the thing was quite simple. When you look at high-dimensional models, it becomes much more complex how to do it. Because if you think of yourself as having, for example, a 100-dimensional problem, which would correspond to looking at an instrument 100 time steps into the future. Now you're trying to generate random numbers in a 100-dimensional space and trying, or these deterministic sequence, and getting the uniform distribution is much more difficult. Yes?
Quick question. It is in the numerical recipes book, and it's not displeased to program this particular method.
This is not...
If it is in numerical recipes,
which ones are?
Bowers.
Okay. Those would be... The other thing I know, that like Sobel sequences are available on the internet. And if you actually... I used the Web Explorer to find it, so I found a Sobel sequence from it.
But is it easy to program yourself, or is it very complicated?
No, you can do it. It's certainly doable. The algorithms are described, for example, in the book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But the other thing, by the way, that this is another point to mention with these sequences, is that there are theoretical properties regarding the convergence. In fact, when it comes to estimating these instruments, that some sequences work much better than others. And even there was no theoretical difference in them, but as far as in practice getting faster convergence, we found some work better than others. Yes?
How does it deal with the global constraints, say, you cannot buy more than 40 instruments?
Yeah. Well, the trouble with that constraint is that what it would tend to do is, as you would fix investment decisions and make certain decisions, whatever you hadn't fixed, it would make fractional. It would just keep pushing the fractionality down. So what that meant was you'd end up going a lot deeper into your branch and bound decision tree before you'd resolve it. We were still resolving it, but it was a matter of, you know, these are the ones that would take days instead of minutes to solve. No. In fact, what we would tend to do on that is we would try and simulate those constraints by putting a certain cost involved in... That's right. And...
A simple cost.
Right.
Nothing that you can look at by the number that they do on there.
No. We just would take, say, look, for the number of... When you make moves, that's going to cost you a certain amount, so don't make too many moves. Because once you say, if you make a move, you must make a fair jump in your portfolio, we say the total amount you change shouldn't be greater than this amount. And if it costs you a certain amount to make these moves, then it ends up limiting the number of constraints. And in fact, these were soft rules. They said, well, 15 constraints out of 20 is all right. So this kind of a this worked out all right.
Were you allowing short selling in this? Because one of the standard criticisms of Markovitz's portfolio with no short selling is that it doesn't diversify. It's all the theory.
Yeah, we were allowing short selling. What we would in fact do is we would put in two versions of an instrument, a long and a short instrument version of it, so that it would take a positive position in one or the other, which would correspond to a short or a long. And that also let us put in the different cost for going short or long. That was how we did that.
Indeed, I mean, if plug for the first kind of model, you would say that one of the points of that kind of model is that it always does diversify.
Yes.
It's basically
yes.
a variety.
Questions? Well, before I forget, there will be a small reception upstairs afterwards, and if anybody wishes to ask Bill any questions, then I'm sure he'll do his best to answer them. if you get lost, take the lift to the fifth floor and follow the throng. We have lots of public lectures at the LSE. We've had cabinet ministers here giving public lectures, and people have got up and walked out in the middle of them. I have to say, however, that Bill's lecture has been listened to very attentively, in fact, the most attentive audience I have known for a public lecture, and I think that pays its own tribute to the lecture that we've heard this evening. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.